Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Fort Campbell Army Base in Kentucky is in a three-day shutdown to deal with a wave of soldier suicides. Fort Campbell leaves the Army in suicides, 11 this year, 2 last week. Yesterday, Brigadier General Stephen Townsend told troops it has to stop. In a few minutes, a new Army mental health website. But first, Fort Campbell. The post is home to the 101st Airborne Division, with brigades seeing at least 3 tours of duty in Iraq and some soldiers serving more tours in Afghanistan. Today, commanders are fanning out to find at-risk soldiers. Mary Claire Lindbergh's son, Army Sergeant Benjamin Miller, was based out of Fort Campbell. He took his life last year while in Minnesota on leave from Iraq. And first, Mary Claire joins us from St. Paul. Mary Claire, so sorry about your son.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Well, and your thoughts on what Fort Campbell is doing now, a shutdown?
I'm so pleased to see this step being taken, because when we get to the point where we're losing more of our soldiers to combat-related suicide than we are to actual combat, we need to do something to change things.
Yeah.
We need to be more aware.
Well, and tell us more about your son's experience. Do you know, did he seek mental health treatment?
He actually received treatment in about March of last year. They did do medications for him, but as far as having any kind of counseling, it was not something he felt as a soldier that he could do and then expect his men to stand up and be strong.
Tell us more about that. So he didn't want counseling. Why?
There's a stigma. If you are a sergeant and you have gentlemen underneath you, how do you tell them they have to soldier up and be strong, and then you're seeking help at the same time? And I truly believe that had Ben just stayed in Iraq rather than coming home on his own, Ben would have returned with the rest of his unit in November.
Huh. So a part of it, a major part of it for Ben, it sounds like, is that he wasn't on the base. He wasn't in Iraq surrounded by troops. He was feeling alone in Minnesota with his issues.
When we have a situation like that, how do you come home and expect the friends you went to school with to understand what you've gone through? For Ben, a large portion of it was the children. He had many pictures taken with children. Ben always adored children. And when it was time to send care packages, he didn't really want anything for him. He just wanted things he could give out to the children. So I think it's quite hard to have them get to know these children and then the next day be out and they're clearing fields and he's recognizing body parts. He said, I can't pick up any more baby parts. Mm. He just couldn't do it. Psychologically, there's a huge difference between being home and then being on his own here and expecting him to get back on a plane and head back into hell. Might have been just more than he could handle.
Well, and we're going to hear about a new Army outreach program using websites and a phone line, because they are aware that there are mental health facilities for troops across the country, but sometimes they're hours away from where those troops might be. But what about the attitude? You talk about the stigma, and some of it sounds like it's internal from Ben. He felt he couldn't let his men down. But did your son also feel that there was an external pressure on him not to have a problem?
I don't know that I would say that. I know the service, the military, I give them utmost credit. They have done what they can, but there's so much more that needs to be done. And today is a first step when we see the step-down program taking place at Ben's base in Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Yeah. I want to ask you just one last thing. I know you went and visited Fort Campbell after your son died to see where he'd been, to meet his friends. And you saw that his name wasn't on the memorial wall listing names of soldiers who died in combat. Your thoughts about what needs to happen there?
I think that these men are every much a victim or casualty of the war as someone who is in Iraq and their life is taken.
And I just, you know, to pick up on that thought, putting your son's name on the wall would acknowledge that something was happening, that it seems as if the military is now acknowledging. Is that a part of it? You know, just saying, this is happening, let's deal with it.
That's, I think, my main concern is that we need to start dealing with it. And I'd like to say that when I was in Fort Campbell in March, any of the phone numbers I called, I took great satisfaction in the fact that when the call went through, the first thing that was answered on each call I made to each number was, if this is a problem concerning morale, press one. So I feel that anybody on the base who needs help is able to pick up a phone and call and ask for the help. I don't know if that's the same situation over in Iraq, but I would pray that it is.
That's Mary Claire Lindbergh. Her son, Sergeant Benjamin Miller, took his own life last year while on home leave from Iraq. Mary Claire has been speaking to us from St. Paul, Minnesota, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin, for having some time with me.
And best to you. Best to
you.
Thank you. Well, let's turn now to Pastor Tommy Vallejos of the Faith Outreach Church, where hundreds of soldiers from Fort Campbell are members. Pastor Vallejos also was a soldier for 21 years himself. Pastor, what are you hearing about the shutdown at Fort Campbell today?
Well, we're just hearing that it was probably a little bit slow reacting, but now it's about time that we paid attention to the mental health of our soldiers, and the families are really appreciative that now we're concentrating on this area that had before not necessarily neglected, but not as much attention was paid to. Being a pastor, and over the years since the wars have been going on, we've had soldiers coming in and out of our office asking for help, and so now they can go for help, and as many had feared before, if you go for help, this could be a look down on your career, but mm-hmm. The Army is saying it's okay to come and seek help.
Well, and we've heard troops say that it's considered, you know, a scarlet letter. If you ask for help, you have your weapon removed, which makes you feel as if you can't support your fellow troops. Is that the kind of thing you're hearing?
Oh, yes, definitely. There's call for concern, and this is across the board. It's just not Fort Campbell. It's our military. It's a strain when you're fighting a war in two parts of the world, and it's a strain on our military, strain on their family, and you're asking our soldiers to do something which is mentally tough, and being a soldier of 21 years, I understand that.
Well, and what are some of the things troops are telling you that's causing them to feel this way? It would seem obvious, war, but is it deployments, or what is it?
It's the many deployments. You know, you're here 1 year and you're gone the next year, and then you come back again, and so you can expect to rotate out, and it's tough.
Joe Varney is Fort Campbell's sole suicide prevention program manager. You may know him, and he told the Tennessean newspaper that a profile has emerged of the people who do take their lives, white males between 19 and 25, and that 70% of the deaths come after the soldier has a breakdown in their personal relationship. Does that conform with what you hear?
Oh yeah, definitely. You see these young soldiers, they're trying to leave civilian life and then conform to military life, and suddenly you find yourself in the face of war. And then you're facing an enemy who doesn't care about your family, doesn't care about your freedom, doesn't care about your country. You're fighting them, then you come home and suddenly your wife wants a divorce, your husband wants a divorce. There's chaos in the home front. I'm not only having to face an enemy who doesn't care, now I'm having to face a home with drama. And so you can understand the strain on that relationship when I'm told I want a divorce.
No. Is the closing of the base resonating around town? How are people reacting to that?
You can go to the bloggers in our local paper and hit a couple pages there. And one blogger writes, how about being in charge of your own action? I don't know how many weekends my husband has to go to work to babysit some of his soldiers. Should I move them to all my house?
Some people still think these troops are being coddled by their dressing.
It's both sides. And then, of course, there's the positive. I agree with a lot of what has been said in the comments. The general is trying to motivate the soldiers to look up and keep their head up and comfort them. And I think there comes a time, you know, because you can be hard. I was an infantry guy. Hey, we used to say a word, suck it up and drive on. Well, this is not a time to tell the soldiers, suck it up and drive on. This is a time to, hey, I hear you. I feel your pain. And let's sit down and talk about it. And I'm glad that the military has seen it fit to do this.
That's Pastor Tommy Vallejos of the Faith Outreach Church there in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Pastor Vallejos, thanks so much for speaking with us.
No problem.
Well, just last week, the Army launched the Real Warriors campaign with a website and a toll-free number to help troops with mental health issues. But as an Iraq War vet told the New York Daily News, you can say there's no stigma, but the first thing that's going to happen is you're going to be put on a no-weapon status, and that's a scarlet letter. Brigadier General Lori Sutton is the Army's top psychiatrist. She says stress has been called battle fatigue, shell shock, soldier's heart during the Civil War. She tells troops it's a problem that goes back to mythological figures like Ajax and the Trojan War. And we asked her, how will she overcome the thinking that keeps troops from getting help?
Well, you know, that gets to the heart of this campaign. With our culture of sort of a suck it up and drive on macho culture, I think it becomes even more difficult for folks to step forward and to get the help that's out there. And so part of what this campaign is designed to do over a period of several years is to feature the stories of real warriors who talk in very candid detail about the real battles they've experienced. Folks like Marine Sergeant Josh Hopper. This is a young sergeant who had two combat deployment tours, saw a lot of very tough, traumatic duty, performed magnificently, came back home, and for a period of months, you know, he held it all together at work, but it was at home that he became isolated and very distant and removed from those that he loved most. And it wasn't until his command sergeant major was reading the citation for his combat award back here on the home front that he started to relive what had happened. Fortunately, his commander saw what was happening, took him aside, and Sergeant Hopper acknowledged, "Yes, sir, I am having trouble. I need help." His command team got him to get help, and the profile will show you how his command team now says, you know, he's back, he's on the team, getting to work, and he's stronger than ever.
But how do you change the thinking of the command team? You well know that NPR did an investigation of the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder in the military, Daniel Zwirling's reporting, and found that officers at Fort Carson in Colorado would punish or even kick out soldiers, but certainly demean and denigrate them if they asked for help with depression. What are you going to do to change the culture that way?
It starts with the examples of command teams like Sergeant Hopper's. As we go down this road, you know, we're on a journey. We've made a lot of progress, but certainly we know we've got a long ways to go. And the more that we can really launch a different level of dialogue through this Real Warriors campaign by harnessing the stories of those who are out there now and connecting with the experiences of warriors from different conflicts, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, we can get a different level of dialogue going, a different level of connection, and yes, a different level of action and compassionate leadership.
And will you promise to be there on the other end? I just see your website getting swamped.
Robin, we should have such problems. I would welcome that. And in fact, we are ready, leaning forward, monitoring the website, the call center, and as we continue to hear from individuals around the country, and even we've been contacted to other countries are interested in being part of this effort as well. And so we would love to have that challenge of increasing our resources and ability to respond to those who are interested in being part of this campaign.
General Sutton, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you so much, Robin. Take care now.
That's Brigadier General Lori Sutton, the Army's top psychiatrist and director of the Defense Centers of Excellence for Psychological Health and Traumatic Brain Injury. We'll link you to the Real Warriors website at ours, hereandnow.org. You should call 911, she says, if you are in an emergency. But the toll-free number to talk to someone is 866-966-1020. Takes a few minutes to pick up what someone does. We'll come back with Chicago politics here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. The word embattled comes up a lot when politicians are in trouble, but it really seems the only adjective for Illinois Senator Roland Burris, who was already facing an ethics probe in Congress and a perjury investigation back home in Illinois, and is now facing more questions after the release of a wiretap in which he expresses interest in the U.S. Senate seat being vacated by President-elect Barack Obama and offers to make a political donation to the campaign of then-Governor Rob Blagojevich of Illinois. Here is Burris last November responding to this donation request from the governor's brother and chief fundraiser, Robert.
you know, if you guys can just write checks, that'd be fine if we can find a way for you to tie in.
Okay. I will personally do something. Okay.
All right, Roy.
And it'll be done before the 15th of December.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Hey, okay. You're a good friend. I'll pass on your message.
Please do, and tell Rod to keep me in mind for that seat, would you?
I'll let him know.
Federal agents taped that conversation as part of their investigation of Governor Rod Blagojevich, who was eventually arrested on 16 counts of corruption and forced out of office. Well, Clarence Page is the nationally syndicated Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Clarence, we rush to say that Senator Burris is arguing the tapes show he didn't pay to play, so to speak, because he might have offered a personal donation, but he never sent it. And he felt he had just had to say those things to get that seat. So your take on all of this?
Right. He's being the good lawyer, speaking in very lawyerly terms. And when you listen to the tape, you can hear a guy who sounds like he's trying to phrase his wishes and sentiments in ways that will not be indictable. I don't think it necessarily works. But what Burris does argue is that he never asked for a quid pro quo or made gestures in that direction, and essentially that on the one hand, you know, he just wants to help Governor Blagojevich. He wants to make some kind of a donation, but he doesn't want it to be construed by anybody as some kind of a quid pro quo, since the governor was under investigation at the time. But meanwhile, I am interested in that Senate seat. You know,
right.
It's like he's kind of he tries to treat that as though it's kind of incidental.
Well, let's listen to a little more of the tape, because he is worried, or does seem to be worried, about any appearance of a trade for a Senate seat. Let's listen.
Answer me this question, because I'm very much interested in trying to replace Obama. Okay.
Now, so you and let me just tell you, Roland, and 1 million other people.
That's right. That's right.
Of every race, color, creed, and faith. It's
so
amazing.
It is. And so if I put on a fundraiser now, it would have some. I mean, this is what I've been talking to Fred about. It has so many negative connotations that Burris is trying to buy an appointment from the governor for the Senate seat.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to figure out how to deal with this and still be in the consideration for the appointment.
I hear you.
So does that clear him a little bit, Clarence Page?
Well, it says, the thing is, he's saying that just the fact that he talked about the Senate seat and talked about a donation to the governor in the same conversation doesn't mean the two are linked as a quid pro quo. Reform groups like the Better Government Association, a long-standing reform group in Chicago and Illinois, they say that that's just a distinction without a difference, that the law says that just you're talking about these two things in the same conversation essentially asks for a quid pro quo with a nod and a wink. You seldom have somebody getting on the phone and saying, "Hey, give me a bribe, and I'll give you a Senate seat," or vice versa.
Send me a check, and oh, by the way, and then the response being, "Yes, I will," and remember about that seat. Well, but Senator Burris is also facing a perjury investigation by the Sangamon County Prosecutor in Illinois, because we're wondering, you know, it's a perjury investigation. Will this tape be a part of it? And why wasn't this tape? Why didn't this tape surface before? He never said anything about this conversation, and he's saying today that he wasn't asked about it.
Well, remember, the U.S. attorney didn't release any tape when he first announced his affidavit against Governor Blagojevich. He quoted from the tape, but never played it. The U.S. attorney's been holding on to the tape, and it's the U.S. Senate and their ethics committee that requested the U.S. attorney release the tape, and he finally did this week. That's basically the answer to that question. Beyond that, these investigations are going on with the both in Springfield, Illinois, and in Washington. And my newspaper's web page is headlining that the U.S. attorney is going to announce an indictment today, believed to be of an elected official. That's all we know.
Well,
it is
Chicago, so
it could be anybody.
I don't mean that. But Clarence Page, just briefly, you've known Burris for 30 years. Your wife was his speechwriter at one time. He was the first African-American to be elected to statewide office in Illinois history. Did he just get caught doing business as usual, or is he potentially just caught doing business as usual? What do you think is happening here in the minute we have?
Well, you know, I think Roland Barthes, I've always said that his only sin was narcissism, that he was always a big self-promoter. People know about his legendary mausoleum and all that with his resume etched in marble.
He's chiseled the world's words trailblazer across the mausoleum.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows he was eager to have a Senate seat. He tried unsuccessfully to be governor, senator, mayor of Chicago a total of 5 times, never got past the primary. This was his best shot now at age 72, I believe, finally get a Senate seat, and he may have just overdone it. Certainly you can hear it in those tapes and all. There's that eagerness to get that Senate seat, and by the way, I just really want to give the governor some money, blah, blah, blah. That's the sort of thing that he's too close to the edge here. I think he could really be in trouble this time.
That's Clarence Page, nationally syndicated Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Chicago Tribune, talking about the hottest news in Chicago politics right now, and we'll, of course, follow the story of Illinois Senator Roland Barthes for you. Clarence, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, still ahead today, the confessions of bad parents. They will speak out when we come back here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
Try to body it. Do you know the law that says you can't idle your car engine on the streets of New York for more than 3 minutes?
Really?
Yeah. This is the law. It explains it.
Okay.
There's pretty heavy fines if you do. So it'll be great for the sake of better air that you can shut off the car engine.
I will.
Here, hang on to this.
Thank you very much.
Well, that was amicable. That's George Pakenham trying to get a New York driver to stop idling his car. It's surprising it's so pleasant because, well, it's New York. But also, George is not a city employee. He's a Wall Street banker who's concerned that a 1971 law banning idling for more than 3 minutes in most cases is not being enforced. And so he's, as we heard, handing out cards with the law printed on them. It's his own one-man awareness campaign. We read about George in The New Yorker. He joins us now. And, George, I'm a native New Yorker, so I can be surprised. Do people always respond that way?
I've done this about 1,800 times over 2.5 years, and I'm about 80% successful. By success, I mean people actually shut their engines off when I ask them to do so. And so are they friendly? Moreover, they're a little bit bewildered. They don't know who I am, and they just sort of take it all in. And actually, I always try to give them instruction at the end. You know, it would be a good idea if you could shut your engine off to have cleaner air in New York.
Right.
So I do give them a call to action, so to speak.
Well, and you keep track of everything on an Excel spreadsheet. Why? Why do you—I mean, this is time-consuming. You're going out on the streets, interacting with perfect strangers. Why do you do this?
Yeah, you know, it's not that much of a time expense or an effort. I typically do it on my way to work and then back from work. It's just become a part of my life because— You know, one, I earnestly want cleaner air in the city, and two, I hate to see waste, and particularly, you know, oil waste or gasoline waste, and it bothered me, and I wanted to reach out and somehow affect the city in which I love.
Well, you're also concerned about revenue for the city. You've distributed nearly 2,000 cards over the past 2.5 years. How much money would the city have taken in if instead of you there was somebody handing out tickets?
Yeah, it would be roughly $360,000 or so.
Well, you pointed this out to city officials in the last year, and now, in addition to the existing law, there's a new law that says that there can't be any idling in front of schools for more than a minute. There was also a rule change. Now, traffic code enforcement officers can enforce the idling law, along with city cops and officials from the Department of Environmental Protection. So enforcement has been one of your biggest concerns. Do you think the traffic police will enforce this law?
Well, that's a very good question. I guess I'm skeptical as to the teeth behind that rule change. I worry that it would just be a nuisance to them and it will be disregarded, and I can't afford to let that happen. I think that heavy enforcement is the key to success here.
Boy, you are like a dog with a bone on this.
I'm a bit skeptical, but I love New York City, and I want it to be the leader in having a clean air push, and I think idling would have a lot to do with making it a finer city to live.
Meantime, you've had some run-ins, we understand, with EMS vehicles and ambulances. They have to idle, and they're allowed to, because they have certain medications to keep at room temperature. But, you know, what are some of the other encounters you've had where it really hasn't been as easy as the one we've heard?
It's never come to physical violence, let's put it that way. You know, I've had stern words with people, and it's gotten interesting once or twice. But out of almost 1,800 encounters, it's really quite minor. And it's not something that the citizenry should fear, because I'm hoping that they become part of this. You know, there's a great awareness. The New Yorker article has had people call me and email me from many parts of the country being enlightened by this. And so I'm encouraged that people are reaching out and saying, hey, I'm thinking about this too, and this has been bothering me for a long time. What do I do? Give me some help. And it's been really wonderful. And I think we're on to something here.
George Pakenham, when he's not working as a Wall Street banker in New York City, he's knocking on drivers' windows, reminding them that it's illegal to idle for more than 3 minutes. George, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, and we just want to take a second to say we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or any story. Just go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email. I read every single one. Or you can leave a comment on our phone line, 617-358-0397. Or leave a comment right there on the homepage at hereandnow.org. Back in half a minute. Here and Now. Now, this next segment might not be appropriate if you've got some rugrats listening. It's about parenting. Now, that parents write about parenting isn't new. What's new is a slew of books with parents confessing honest, negative feelings about parenting.
Look, I tell the other T-ball mothers, childhood is oppressive. I determine what the boy's eating and when. I tell him when he's going to bed and when he can get up. I tell him when he can speak and when he must remain silent. There are certain things he's forbidden from ever saying, including not spaghetti again and dad would let me. But wouldn't you agree that motherhood is equally oppressive? Because of the boy, I can't drop $50 on a pair of shoes. I can't fly to Paris on a moment's notice. I can't stay out all night. I can't even get liquored up when I need to.
We said it was honest. That's Here and Now's literary critic and writer Steve Almond reading from Diane Joseph's I'm Sorry You Feel That Way, the astonishing but true story of a daughter, sister, slut, wife, mother, and friend to man and dog. It joins Ayelet Waldman's memoir Bad Mother, Michael Lewis's Home Game, An Accidental Guide to Fatherhood, and Rebecca Wolfe's Rockabye, From Wild to Child, in a new genre that some are calling bad parenting. And Steve Almond joins us here in the studio to talk about it. Steve's contributed to the anthologies Blindsided by a Diaper and The Book of Dads, Essays on the Joys, Perils, and Humiliations of Fatherhood. He's the proud papa of Josie, 2.5, and Judah, 6 months old. Steve, welcome back to Here Now.
Yes.
From sort of your paternity leave.
Yeah.
On doing all this thing. But, you know, so people understand what this new genre is. It's not just, oh, gee, I'm having trouble breastfeeding. What are some of the things that parents are confessing?
Oh, gosh. And sort of like, what aren't they confessing? I mean, you have websites, for instance. There's a book that's going to be coming out called True Confessions. I think it's, you know, moms taking pleasure in testing, quote-unquote, the child's coordination by pushing them over.
Well, we're reading of other confessions in other places. Apparently, a mother in British Columbia wrote, you know, she was kidding on Twitter that she wanted to smother her 3-year-old. The police came to her door, and she said, oh, I was just kidding. Other mothers are confessing on something called Babbel.com. Now, you used to have a blog on Babbel.com.
Yes, they have an entire column called Bad Parent, and they're going to sweep these up into a book. And you have things like parents admitting that, you know, a couple of women who were both breastfeeding, kind of like one of them, they traded kids, which I don't consider so astonishing or horrible, but there are things that this culture of super parenting, you know, people would be aghast to learn that such things happen.
Well, we understand that because of that column, Bad Parent, and people confessing other things, like one woman admitting she allows her little one to watch 6 hours of TV a day, a third admits that she hates her daughter's friend, who is three. You know, these confessions.
I don't have a big problem with that. There's plenty of 2 and 3 year olds that I could do with that.
Well, this is the new attitude, to say what you think. And we understand, you know, the bad parent column is one of the most popular features on that site. But a year ago, you stopped writing your blog on Babbel.com. Now, why?
Well, let me actually back up before I answer that question and try to suggest why I think there's this genre that has gotten so huge so fast. And I think it has to do with a number of cultural forces colliding. For one thing, 30 or 40 years ago, there was just a cultural expectation that you would have kids. There was a real frowning on talking about publicly the way that you parented. And also, you have to think about a lot of parents, and my wife and I included, we no longer have, 30 or 40 years ago, it wouldn't be unusual to have an extended family around who dispensed all the wisdom. And at this point, a lot of upwardly mobile parents are waiting longer. They're super self-conscious about having kids, and they don't have a lot of guidance. So what emerged was this entire set of books, What to Expect When You're Expecting, that were all about the perfect parenting mission. And you had a lot of women who were serious professionals who were used to sort of high achieving, and they had to be super moms. And I think a lot of these books about bad parenting, quote unquote, is really just another way of saying, honestly, sometimes our kids drive them nuts, and that sometimes they don't want to be changing the 15th diaper of the day.
Oh, I love one confession. I can't remember where it was, of a mother who confessed that when she ran out of diapers, she used paper towels and tape
to do a diaper.
But it's dads, too, rejecting this sort of requirement that they do it perfectly.
That they do it perfectly and that they love doing it all the time. And kids these days, Robin, they're being brought up in a way that is fundamentally different from the way we were, in the sense that at 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, they are computer savvy. They're able to do Google searches. They're able to find everything that might be out there on the internet and will never go away. And so you have the prospect of, like, Ayelet Waldman, who, you know, wrote this well-known essay about feeling that she loved her husband more than her kids.
Her husband being?
Michael Chabon, you know, the wonderful novelist, which is, I mean, I think that's a fairly crazy thing to say. Just, you love people in different ways, but you never know. The worst thing would be if your kids start feeling hurt or troubled by what you've put out there.
Well, and let's hear a little more of what people are putting out there. What have you got?
Well, I wanted to read a little bit from Robert Wilder's wonderful book, Daddy Needs a Drink. I have to say that I do best with this genre when it's comic in nature and sort of brutally honest, but uses comedy to deal with it.
Well, and I just have to throw in, Irma Bombeck did that. Mm-hmm. You know,
like everything, they sort of, it comes in waves, and everybody says, oh, there's this new thing happening. It's always been out there, right?
Yeah.
It just wasn't for the whole world.
Yeah.
So I'll read a little bit from Daddy Needs a Drink, these very funny essays by Robert Wilder. Some adults say the hardest thing about parenting is the questions their children ask. Why is the sky blue and the sunset red? Shocks us all the first time. And these inquiries get even more complex, ranging from the origin of our species to existentialist matters such as what God wears to bed and why gerbils so happily eat their young. Then there are the more personal and frightening queries of where babies come from. When will Daddy die? And the whopper my daughter Poppy unloaded on me recently, what is rape? Makes you want to cut out your own tongue with infant nail clippers.
Yeah. You say there's also a subgenre of accidental parents. Give us a reading from that.
Yeah, sure. This is from actually somebody who is a Babbel blogger as well, a woman named Rebecca Wolf. She has a wonderful memoir that came out last year, Rockabye, From Wild to Child. And here's how it begins. I must be drunk or on drugs or dreaming. My breasts are not sore, and the nausea I've been feeling is just a week-long hangover. I had a lot to drink last week at the 3 of Clubs, 5 rounds or so. There is no way I can be pregnant. I light up a cigarette and lean out the window of my bedroom. My hands are shaking. My tattoos itch. I'm not pregnant, I say aloud. And she goes on and on here. And the memoir is especially touching because I think it's a community that isn't often written about as parents. More and more you're seeing people in their early 20s eschew the idea of becoming parents at all because they want to go to clubs and get drunk and have time before they're literally, you know, having to change diapers all the time.
It's the kind of writing that you listen to and you think, well, at least she's honest.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Steve Almond, Here and Now's literary critic on this new genre of parents being honest about their parenting. And by the way, Steve, we point out your latest essays are in the anthologies Blindsided by a Diaper and The Book of Dads, Essays on the Joys, Perils, and Humiliations of Fatherhood. And Steve, just a thought from you. What is something that you've, or maybe you and your wife have confessed to, you know, hating, even though parents are supposed to love it?
Kids are, among the many other things they are, unbelievably boring people to converse with. an aunt who's sort of losing it, but is totally insistent on being a part of the conversation. So I'm completely unrepentant, even though I think our daughter is charming and she's a genius and blah, blah, blah. Like, sometimes it is just deadly boring to converse with her.
Let's hope Josie never learns how to look up show archives.
That's right. She'll march right in here and insist on having an equal time.
Steve, thanks so much.
Sure.
Josh Gwinnett, you are not boring. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, The Grapes of Wrath Revisited, towns combining book readings and job fairs. That's tomorrow. Back with Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, Here and Now. One of the top sellers on one of the New York Times bestseller lists is an adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. But from the very first sentence, you know, this isn't your grandmother's Jane Austen.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a zombie in possession of brains must be in want of more brains. Never was this truth more plain than during the recent attacks at Netherfield Park, in which a household of 18 was slaughtered and consumed by a horde of the living dead.
Yes, Jane, Netherfield was invaded by zombies, and your heroine, Elizabeth, is not only beautiful and smart, but she's now been trained by fighting masters to defend England against the plague of the living dead. Yet another obstacle to Elizabeth finding love with the proud but handsome Mr. Darcy. Insert sigh here. Seth Graham Smith is listed as the author, along with Jane Austen, of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, and he joins us from the NPR West Studios in Culver City, California. Seth, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Why? Why'd you do this?
Because I thought it was funny. This grew out of a conversation that I had with an editor at the publisher Quirk Books, and they had been wanting to do some kind of a remix, they were calling it, of a classic book for a long time. And an editor there named Jason Rakulak had been keeping lists of books like Wuthering Heights or War and Peace. And on the other side of this column, he would have things like pirates and robots and monkeys, and he was just looking for the perfect combination. And one day he called me very excitedly and said, you know, I think I found it. And the next words out of his mouth were Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. And I was instantly struck by it. I mean, I had a vision right then and there of these Regency-era aristocrats running for their lives and of the Bennet sisters flying around like they were in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon or something.
Or a Michael Jackson Thriller video.
Or a Thriller video, or some people call it Jane Austen meets the Matrix. I mean, you know, whatever pops into your mind. But that's what popped into mine. And I thought, that is just too much fun not to do.
Well, and for anyone who doesn't know the book, speaking of gratuitous, you know, it's gratuitous love affairs and concerns. Let's have a brief synopsis. Hit it. Elizabeth is the second of five daughters of Mr. Bennet, a gentleman but of reduced means. Her mother, determined to marry off all the girls, her sister Jane and Mr. Bingley fall in love but are temporarily parted by Bingley's sisters and his best friend, Mr. Darcy, who thinks the Bennet family isn't good enough for his friend but still falls in love with Elizabeth. He proposes, she rejects him because of what he did to her sister Jane, but soon that changes and they all fall in love and everyone gets married. Have I got it right, Seth?
Absolutely.
Okay, you sum up the zombie side of your story.
Well, in this version, Elizabeth is still the fiercely independent, sharp-tongued woman that she is in the original, although I now have added a sharp dagger to her hands, and she is one of the, along with her sisters, premier slayers of the zombie menace, which is haunted England for some 50-odd years now. Strangely, the English, being English, have decided not to leave England, but rather to adopt the zombie menace as just another part of English life. The things play out sort of like they do in the original book, only there's much more blood and far more zombies than in the original, and eventually, after slaying untold numbers of the unmentionable menace, Elizabeth and Darcy fall in love and become the deadliest couple in all of England.
Well done. Well, and you say your qualification for writing the book is that you once took a course in English literature.
That's about it.
But you do incorporate quite a bit of the original text. So here's what we're going to do just to give people a flavor. I'll read a paragraph from the original. Of what a woman must do to be called accomplished. A woman must have a thorough knowledge of music, singing, drawing, dancing, all the modern languages, to deserve the word. And besides all this, she must possess a certain something in her air and manner of walking, the tone of her voice, her address and expressions, or the word will be but half deserved. Now, Seth Grandsmith, would you please read Mr. Darcy's description of the attributes an accomplished woman must possess?
A woman must have a thorough knowledge of music, singing, drawing, dancing, and the modern languages. She must be well-trained in the fighting styles of the Kyoto masters and the modern tactics and weaponry of Europe. And besides all this, she must possess a certain something in her air and manner of walking, the tone of her voice, the address and expressions, or the word will be but half deserved.
What did you have to do to write this? Did you already know Pride and Prejudice? What did you do?
Well, I had forgotten most of it. I read Pride and Prejudice once when I was 14, and being a 14-year-old boy, I didn't exactly appreciate all the subtleties of Jane Austen's writing, nor did I care all that much about Elizabeth Bennet's man troubles. So when I reread it, knowing that I was going to do this book, it was like a light going off, and all of a sudden it's like I said, oh, I get it. Jane Austen is funny. You know, besides being brilliantly plotted and besides having brilliantly drawn characters and, you know, all those things that we all know and expect and make it one of the most beloved books in the English language, that was the real surprise to me reading it in my 30s. Is that it was very funny. And it seemed like the people in her original book are kind of like zombies in a way. You know, they live in this immense bubble of wealth and privilege, and they go on with their lives wondering, you know, who's dating who and who has the nicest lamb at their supper. You get the sense that in the original books, the countryside could be burning down around them and they would just carry on with their lives. And really the only thing that I've changed in this version is the country is burning down around them.
Well, a couple of things struck us. First of all, we're not so sure it's a good idea for Elizabeth to have a weapon, because in the exchanges, you know, the famous scene in which Darcy first proposes to her, she's repulsed by his arrogance. In your adaptation, they're both accomplished sword fighters, so we're not sure if he's going to propose or she's going to kill him.
Well, she comes close to killing him. You know, they get into it, you know, and there's a lot of verbal sparring between Darcy and Elizabeth in the original Pride and Prejudice, and the only change here is that it's verbal and literal sparring at some points.
What kind of reaction have you received from Austen fans?
When I wrote this book, I was sure that I was going to be burned in effigy, but by and large, the Austen fans have embraced the book and see it for what it is, a silly exercise that doesn't really take itself too seriously and, you know, is done, you know, from a place of reverence for the original. If anything, actually, it's brought people into the Jane Austen tent who never in their lives would have picked up a Jane Austen book before this. I've spoken to many people who've said, you know, I never thought I could get through a Jane Austen book until I read yours, and now I'm going to go and try another one.
Well, do you plan other classics? Because you said your publisher was thinking of it. You could have War and Peace and Zombies or Remembrance of Things Zombie.
Things like Wuthering Heights Reloaded or War and Peace and More War. I mean, you could go on and on. Sense and Sensibility and Vampires. I'm working on something that's a little different right now. Instead of remixing a book, I'm remixing a very famous life. I'm working on a book right now called Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, which is intended to read like a straight-laced biography in the style of people who I love to read, like McCullough and Isaacson and Doris Kearns Goodwin, to tell Lincoln's story, which has been told so many times in so many different ways, in an attempt to explain real events in his life and real events, especially the Civil War, in a new context.
Seth Graham Smith, the author, along with Jane Austen, of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. Seth, please come back with Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.